I don't have nearly the background in physics that you have, but it struck me that it was remarkable because you had a very scientific mind even when you were very young, although you didn't have all the education that you have now. You were able to observe the characteristics of the craft that the Tall Whites flew in, like, for instance, the directions that they flew. You knew where the stars were. You were able to pick up that sometimes they headed towards Arcturus. And sometimes you were able to observe things about the behavior of the technology that they used, for instance, with their suits and with the scout craft and so forth, and even with the big deep spacecraft. It's fascinating to me because you have the perspective of someone who does understand quite a bit about physics, and you've had these experiences that you can then synthesize, and it must be amazing the combination of those two things. You have a background in physics that allows you to kind of analyze and come up with an idea, a theory about how things work, and then you can kind of test that against what you have directly observed of these advanced technologies. To me, that's just fascinating. I've never had the opportunity to hear anyone with that combination of experience and insight provide any type of analysis of these types of things. I mean, it's so rare to have a combination like that. It's just really striking. Maybe you'd like to talk about, you know, that unique combination of education and experience that you have and how that kind of informs your scientific perspective and your theories.
Well, thank you. You're very kind. When I went in the Air Force in July 1964, they give you all those tests to see what you're good at. And I got a perfect score at logical reasoning. You know, 2 and 2 is 4, 4 is 2 and 2.
Yeah.
And I did so by outthinking the great French explorer Cadillac, who was previously considered to be perfect. And I showed where he was. I showed where he was making some blunders. Cadillac, you know, when he came over, he's the one who discovered the Great Lakes. And when he brought a French expedition over in the Age of Discovery, he knew he was going to have to winter over on the North American coast. And previous expeditions had been cut to ribbons by scurvy. And so he knew that in order for he and his men to survive the winter, he was going to have to figure out a cure for scurvy. And this was like 200 years or so before the British did. And his reasoning used to be considered perfect. He succeeded and was the base of the test. And what he did was, He first had the men start building a enclosure, you know, huts and stuff at a place on the American coast where he didn't think the Indians would find them. And then he alone walked for like a week to an Indian village, to a hill overlooking an Indian village, which was down by a river, without letting anyone know he was there. And then in his diary, he recorded everything he was seeing and thinking. And all he was going to do was observe the Indian village to see what they were doing to prevent scurvy. His reasoning was that scurvy makes a man weak. All Indian warriors wanted to be strong. And therefore, all Indian warriors were doing something to keep them strong, i.e. to prevent scurvy. So he watched for a week. And in his diary, he clearly noted on day one at the summit that the Indian children got up before their parents. They all collected down by the river and made a cold tea from the river water by taking bark from trees, not hemlock or poisonous trees, but just bark from trees, dissolving it in water to make the cold tea, and drinking half of it and taking the other half in for their parents to drink in the wigwams. And that was the only thing he could see them all doing. He didn't, after a week, he didn't feel he had a solution. So he spent another week following an Indian warrior around in the woods without letting the Indian warrior know that he was being followed to try to see what the warrior was doing. He still didn't have a solution. Although he noted in his diary that the warrior was still doing that same thing that he learned from as a child, which Cadillac supposed was a religious ritual. And so then he decided he'd have to ask the warrior himself. So one day in a clearing, as the Indian was sitting eating lunch, he showed himself. He was the first white man the Indian had ever seen, and just stood there peacefully. And the Indian, lucky for Cadillac, responded peacefully. And so then he followed the Indian around for another 2 weeks or so, trying to figure out watching the Indian. And that was the only thing he could see the Indian doing, was making the cold tea, after which he waved the Indian goodbye and left, went back to his men and said, let's try making the cold tea. And it works, because vitamin C is in all the bark of all the different trees. And this was considered perfect reasoning by the psychiatrist before I showed him what was wrong with that. What I said was, on day one, that he should not have reasoned that that scurvy makes warriors weak. He should have reasoned that scurvy makes mothers weak. And every child wants the mother to be strong. Every mother wants the child to be strong. So on day one, when he saw the children making this cold tea and feeding it to their mother, he should, right there, remembering he's risking his life to chase around these wild Indians, right there he should have said, I think that's the solution, going back to the village, to his men, because he has to be alive or the whole expedition is going to go to pieces. Right there he should have gone back to his men and said, we're all drinking cold tea like the kids, and then picked one or two men who were expendable and told them to carefully go and watch the village and make sure the Indians did it every day, and to make sure he was right about the Indians doing it every day. Because vitamins are so important to the strength of both children and parents, the Indians would certainly do that first in the morning. Every Indian mother would teach her children first to take their vitamins the way my mother taught me to take my vitamins, and vice versa. And I showed all the ways that Cadillac was missing the boat by never reasoning that women and kids want to stay strong. And the psychiatrist that was doing it was shocked. He said he'd been a psychiatrist for 35 years. He'd never seen anybody reason that way, and he saw that I was perfectly correct. Hmm. The second thing that we'd like to point out is that I had a guy, as you see in book one, after my friend got burned by the aliens in that accident, by the tall whites, and they went around and they picked a guy to always be out there, and they picked me. It was a committee vote based on the Committee of Aliens and the Committee of American Generals. They had the guy that was the highest ranking psychiatrist at the CIA. He was sitting in a room talking to me at Nellis, and they cleared out everybody just so he could talk with me. I mean, cleared out everybody at the hospital and everything there, at the medical offices, so that he could talk to me just in total private. And he had 9 different PhDs in psychiatry and things. And he said that the first time he saw me, he was shocked, because he had been taught that there were like 105 different basic psychological defenses that humans have, but that no one human used them all. The most any one human used was typically 3. An example of a psychological defense is whistling in the dark. You know, like you're walking down the street and you're told that there's a grizzly bear, sitting beside the road, and you're going to try to walk by him. And so you're going to whistle in the dark and pretend he's not there. That's a psychological defense, right?
Okay.
And he said that one of his projects was that there were 3 generals who had 1 star, and that they only had 3 psychological defenses. Each one was only using 3. And he said that in order to make them promotable, he had promised that he would teach them how to have more psychological defenses. And he said when he had told his associates that he would teach them to have 7, that they laughed at him and said if he ever got to 5, he'd be just to teach them how to have 5 psychological defenses, they'd be like 1 in a million. And he said he saw that his associates were going to be right because he was because he had gotten to use four, but he wasn't sure that they'd all get to use five. And he said when the first time he saw me, he was shocked because in the first 15 minutes, he saw me use more than 65 different psychological defenses. He was sure I could use the rest, you know. An example of a psychological defense is where you might say to me, Charlie, you enjoy visiting Las Vegas, Nevada. And I might respond, hey, I'm as shocked as you are, okay? A man like me would, you see, and that's like a psychological defense, even though it's also quite humorous. Another one is where another psychological defense, and you see in my four books, the only way the reason I survived when other men didn't, men who were better than me and braver than me and so on, was because as the psychiatrist was explaining, he said even though there were at least 41 men that had been sent out there in the 7 years before me, he said they didn't have enough psychological defenses to go out and start talking to aliens. See, if you suppose you have a guy whose main psychological defense is whistling in the dark, and he's using that to protect his personality, his very core, and suppose that as he's doing that, you collapse that psychological defense and continue to collapse his personality. Suppose, for example, the bear attacks, and suppose the bear could speak English, and suppose the bear, while it was attacking, could say, and you idiot, you thought I wouldn't notice, and just really crush the guys.
Yeah.
From a personality point of view. He said, once you do that, some men will never recover. Even if they do recover, they have to go back and rest for like 6 months to 2 years. And getting them back to where they would be willing to just be themselves again, most men could never do it. And he said the reason he was voting for me to be on, he was one of the members of the committee. The reason he was voting for me was because in his own words, he said to the others, he said the four stars and the others, he said Airman Hall will be as sane coming off the ranges as he was going out there. He didn't say I was going to be sane going out there. He just said they'd never lay a glove on me. Never lay a glove, right? And I'll give you an actual example of when I had to use that. I'm very religious, and I've always said that I couldn't have accomplished anything without the help of my guardian angels or without God. But I'll give you an example of me using my psychological defense to protect myself. And One day when I was out at range, I was out at range three, and it was just after the noon meal. And in the morning, I had closed up all the doors and windows in the range three lounge before going in for breakfast. And when I came back after lunch, I came back out after breakfast and I took my readings and stuff, and it didn't seem like I was alone. But the range, it was one of those days when the ranges were closed to anybody but me, and I was the only person allowed to go past the range gate. And my clearance said I could never be ordered off the ranges. I could go anywhere I wanted, anytime I wanted, day or night, anywhere in Indian Springs Valley, up in, anywhere in Dreamland, anywhere over in the Dogbone Lake, over to the hangar where the black cars, that was plural, were kept. If I had the guts, and believe you me, it took guts to drive that road out to range, out to Dogbone Lake. You had to go down through the mesquite and stuff for, golly, 40 miles. I mean, it took guts. And I could go anywhere I wanted. And it didn't seem like I was alone because it seemed like there were people over by the Range 3 Lounge, with white people and with white skin. And so after lunch, I decided that I better check on the doors. And I went over there, it was a beautiful day, and it was a warm day. And I was singing, and I was singing my little song by Ricky Nelson, "It's Up to You, Cause I've Done Everything." You know that song. And I said my prayers, and I and and um, And the rules were, if anybody else were out there on that day, that they could be shot. I could never take anyone else out there with me, but if I had, I would not have been in any trouble. It's just they might not have come back alive. And the door was open at the Rentschy Lounge. And the windows, were, that's the door on the north side, where there was only one door, and it was on the north side. And there was a row of windows on the north side, and several of those were open. And when you went in that door, there were two rooms, and the door of the second room was open. And the lounge was just an adobe building, you know, it's not real large. And I could hear somebody moving in the other room. Well, I didn't want to just go in there, because if they broke and panicked, there's only one door in and one door out, that means they'd have to run over me. Mm-hmm. Or if I was blocking the way, they'd have to fire on me. And so I decided that the best thing I could do, since I didn't want to back out or turn my back on anything, is I was just singing my song, and I was saying, I can hear you guys in there, it's me, Airman Hall, I'm the weatherman. And I was in a really good mood. I went over and I sat down at the desk, which was in the first room, and it was on the far wall opposite the door, and there was a telephone in the desk, you see? And I sat there. There were no other windows in the building. There was just the windows along the north side. There were no windows between the two rooms. So I couldn't hear anything in there. And I was singing, and I thought it might have been maybe some range maintenance men playing hooky. And so I was just saying, you know, we could play poker. I got a deck of cards, you know. I'm practicing blackjack for Las Vegas, you know. I can hear you in there. I'm sitting down in the chair. You can come out now. You know, I was just doing stuff like that. And suddenly, as I sat there looking at the door, these three alien women who were about my height, and the tall whites are way frailer. You know, they're very frail. They only weigh like half of what I do. In a line, decided to make a break for it. And they weren't running full out because their hips and knees are a little bit different than ours, so they were shuffling. And but they were still moving, say, like as fast as you and I would if we were double timing. And they came out in a line, and they were all looking at me as they came out the door from the room, the second room, to the outer door. And then when they got outside, they took off running and to the northeast. And when the last lady was looking at me, she said to the others in English, she said, you're right, he's very ugly. And then they all took off running. Remember that earlier on one night I'd said, when they were out, when the aliens were out in the sagebrush and the mesquite behind the buildings, and their natural language is that of horses and animal sounds and meadow sounds like meadowlarks and stuff. I had kind of called out in the dark, you know, you're really frightening me. You know, if you're out here, please just speak English. That way I won't be frightened. You know, I was kind of shouting it out into the darkness, kind of the way you might shout it out to birds or horses or whatever. You know, little horsey, you should speak English. I'll be frightened if you whinny. You know, that kind of, you know, and kind of that kind of attitude. And they apparently had taken that to heart, you know, and passed the word. And the ladies spoke English, and not all tall whites speak English. They had to learn. And I was sitting there. I thought I was nuts. You know, I mean, it was hell. It was 106 in the shade. I thought maybe I was having a heat stroke. And the reason I was really confused was because, you know, if you go nuts and you start hallucinating, aren't your hallucinations supposed to think you're beautiful and strong? And, you know, aren't your hallucinations themselves supposed to be like beautiful women or, you know, piles of money or something or water or something? You know, and I'm sitting there thinking, well, if I'm nuts and I'm hallucinating, how could my hallucinations think that I'm ugly, you know? So then I decided that I must be a new kind of being nuts. You know, I must be like a textbook case. And as soon as the boys in Vienna hear about this, you know, there will be a new kind of Charlie Hall syndrome where you're going nuts and your hallucinations think you're ugly, you know? And then I got up and I kind of stumbled off to the front door, and I was looking to the northeast, and the tall whites, you know, they're real mobile. They could run like 30, 35 miles an hour once they got out in the open and took off. Wow. And they were already like, you know, several miles off to the northeast. You could see them out there in the desert running there. And I'm thinking, well, my golly, why are my hallucinations running away from me? You know, I mean, I must really be sick if I can't, even hallucinate correctly, you know? I decided that I probably should get more, have a better social life. So in true Charlie Hall fashion, I decided that I probably needed to go into Las Vegas and spend more time in the casinos, you know, around other humans. And, you know, but if you had said to me, wait a minute, those are alien ladies, if I'd been willing to accept that they were extraterrestrial women right there as I was sitting there looking at it on that day, I don't think I could have handled the truth. You see, what the psychiatrist said was, see, because I think I'm nuts, because I'm pushed, the problem with the other men was shown like the guy who broke the little boy's arm, and the mother came and said, if you come out here, that I just described in book one, we'll kill you. The problem with him was he only thought he was hallucinating or nuts or dreaming for just a couple of days, and then he realized that it wasn't him, that what he was looking at was real. Well, now he has a real problem. He's got to go out there at 3 a.m, and if they're waiting for him, now how do you keep yourself alive, right? How do you handle the grizzly bear once you realize that's a real grizzly bear? You got to have a plan. You got to have your personality's got to have. You have to have trained yourself in all these other skills, how to treat live grizzly bears in the wild, how to carry. You have to be ready for it. There's so much thinking that has to go on prior to ever just walking down the trail with a grizzly bear sitting on the side of it. You see. Well, with the tall whites, it's even more so. You have, before you're willing to just walk out to the tall whites or to stand there and let them walk in on you, there's a tremendous amount of thought process that has to go on, not just consciously, but subconsciously. You know, because the kids will come up so close to you that if you turn around and take a step, you'll trip over them. Mm. Or you'll be, excuse me, those suits will let them float. You'll be walking along, and they'll literally be floating right up by your shoulder, and they'll drive you nuts. It'll just freak you out, see?
Yeah.
And see, if you haven't done your... If you say, gee, they're real, and this is happening to me before you know what to do, the terror, the other men would... See, I would become afraid. But the other men would become so afraid that it would collapse their personality. Mm-hmm. They would decide that they would never go out there again. They would just sit in the chow hall at 3 a.m. and make up whims and phone in fake weather reports. And the guy before me, you know, went AWOL and spent the last 3 months of his enlistment living in Long Beach, California. And he and all the other guys were just phoning in fake reports covering for him. The Pentagon knew it, but they wouldn't court-martial him because they knew what he was up against. See, and they said, well, maybe that's what he needs to do to stay sane. See, I was the only person that ever just went out there every day, took the weather report, scared or unscared, typically scared, at least for the first 6 months. And in the books you see, what I'm trying to capture is how that felt, how it felt to have to go through all that acclimation, you know. There came, as you see, there just came a day that I was tired of being afraid. There came a day where I decided that I would know the truth or it would kill me, even if it killed me, you know. That on that day, I decided, and you see that in book three, or in book two, in The Journey, there came a day where I decided that it wasn't me, that even if I didn't understand how their ships worked or who they were or how they got here, it wasn't me. That, you know, they always say, so the whole world is wrong. You're right and the whole world is wrong. Right, Charlie? There came a day where I decided I'm right and Einstein and all the physicists are wrong, okay? And, you know, it was almost like I was living a sitcom because I decided that what I saw, and in the book two in The Journey, that night when I went out there and they came in on me, that was the first night where I was certain it wasn't me. The other nights, prior to that, when I would go out there, first I, you know, you'd have the nights of terror, the nights of wonderment, and so on. But there was a period there, where when I was out there and looking at them, and they were standing right there before me, I would treat them as though they were real, but I didn't actually accept or believe that they were real. I was just treating them as though they were real, so to control my fear. And then when I got back into base, I would kind of laugh and say at myself and say, boy, that was a pretty bad nightmare you had today, Charlie. Maybe tomorrow, if you don't throw a rock at that guy and we'll have it land at his feet, maybe he won't, you know, maybe he won't look so angry when you do it, you know. And you know, where you kind of think that you're training yourself to handle your hallucinations. And, you know, but there was, but the day, the book, the chapter, the journey, that was the first day where I just said to myself, whatever it is, it's real, it's not me. And that took more than 6 months to get there. And there were so many times, there were so many things that went on that are not in my books, partly because I was trying to capture how it felt when I wrote it. And the reason nothing about the Tote Grays is in the books is because capturing that is really hard. And there is a little bit of the Norwegians with 34 teeth in the books, but I was trying to capture what was, how it felt to be standing there in front of the tall whites, watching them get off the scout craft, seeing with your own eyes that there's more to physics than what Einstein knew about, that they've come here from another planet, and realizing there's no point in running anywhere because they're coming into your barracks at night. There's no place to run to, no place to hide. Stand here and talk to them or die trying, you know? And how that felt. I'm very religious, and how anybody would do that without a religion is a surprise to me. Or I can't imagine anybody succeeding at that without if they weren't religious. There were so many good men that are, you know, there are so many times that, well, like for example, my good friend from Texas, the one that told me about the legend of Range 4 Harry originally. And he had seen the horse, the high-speed horse formation, he and the major, out in the desert, out at Range 4. And so he knew there was something real out there. And he was certain it was a horse. And one night, I was trying to explain to him. And one day, I'd gone into Nellis when I, at the end of the month, when I was bringing the monthly run for records and stuff. And I went into the weather station, and he was working, and I was trying to explain to him, and we were the best of friends, that I had figured out what Range 4 Harry was, that it's not a horse, that it's extraterrestrials, that if you get up close, it's not a horse, it's people. And he, even though he was one of my best friends, he treated me like I'd either gone nuts or been out there drinking. And he was chiding me and saying, the way a brother would, now, Charlie, you got to remember that you have to be sober when you're going out there. You can't, you know, well, you probably were drinking the night before, and, you know, you might, you know, if you get caught being drunk out in the ranges, you know, that's a court-martial offense. If I'd been drunk out in the ranges, nobody would have cared, because I could do anything I wanted out there. But, you know, he didn't even want to believe that. He was so certain that what he'd rather believe that what he saw was a floating white radioactive horse, a radioactive horse that floated, that didn't need water, that got its food from very far away, that had real long white hair on one side and short white hair on another. He'd rather believe that than as I was trying to explain to him that, no, it's not a horse, it's people, and there's more to physics than what Einstein knew. And he was trying to say, you know, you got to understand, Einstein was a bright man, and he knows more about physics than what you've learned yet. You know, you got to respect that. And in order just to keep him from losing respect for me, I had to laugh and say, well, yeah, I'll try to be more sober when I go off there. Yeah. And that's kind of how part of the, in addition to the fear and the other emotions. There was the frustration of trying to explain it to others. One night when I was out there at Range 3, and the experienced guards brought around a group of new arrivals because the deep spacecraft would put in on the night of the full moon and stay there till the night of the new moon, that's 2 weeks later, And during that 2 weeks, they would take the people on board, the so-called new arrivals, around for tours and show them what the valley was like. There are several thousand tall whites who have only seen one human, and his name is Charlie. Poor devils. I guess they think of all humans as me. And as they were and the guard was explaining to the new arrivals, I'd brought my balloon out, and I'd released it, and I was tracking it. And this was after I'd gotten over the fear, and I'd made friends with the teacher and Range 4 Harry and a tour guide and school bus driver and aircraft mechanic and so on. And the captain, although he was never really friendly, but at least, you know, he was always very formal. Their guard was explaining to their new arrivals how to approach me. And the idea was that the new arrivals would form a line. The guard would come out as I looked at them on the right. He'd come out before our hand. They were all armed. That way he'd be able to guarantee separation between me and them, you see, and that nothing would go wrong. And then they would all advance on me like that. And he was explaining how to do that. He was lining them up and saying how they were going to do that. And of course, since this was in 66, and so he knew that I was used to being around him and that I wasn't in a panic. And there was this one lady who was more or less middle-aged, equivalent to a middle-aged human. They lived like 600 or 800 years, so she'd been like 300, 400 years old. And she was as they were walking in, she was saying to the guard, "But he can see us, and I thought we were always supposed to stay hidden." And the guard was saying, "Yes, but Charlie knows you're in, and we have a special arrangement, and it's okay." And they were just walking in, and they were going to approach me to about 20 feet. And the lady said to the guard, she said, "But now that he knows we're here, will the other humans let him go back to them? You know, or will the other humans ostracize him?" The guard said, "Yes, Charlie is very smart. It appears that when he goes back to the other humans, he doesn't tell them everything he knows or everything he sees. So therefore, the other humans still accept him. He's unusual that way." And that's kind of one of the things I was doing in my books as well, because I'm trying to explain how it felt to live those days day by day, and then to have to be out there with the aliens, and then to have to go back and be talking to other humans, and then to be going down to the Stardust Casino, which was the CIA safe casino, and you'd come across CIA guards and stuff down there, and down at the Four Queens and the Mint and the Hotel Fremont and stuff, and the old Golden Nugget, where the CIA would have their guards and their pit bosses and their dealers come in and cover things. And it seemed like every time you turned around in the casino, there would be your friend, even though he didn't really know, he couldn't ask any questions. He just knew who you were and that you were a friend. And he could listen if you felt like talking. And what that was like, to live those days. And that's what I'm trying to explain. And the way I chose the chapters of the book is some things I felt I was doing better at capturing that emotion, and some things I'm still working on, you know, because I would be willing to bet you that there were several hundred, I mean, that there are really several hundred things that I still would like to explain, but I'm trying to capture the emotion of how it felt, and I'm not criticizing the government or secrecy or anything. I'm just trying to capture how it was for me.